From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a made-for-TV movie dramatizing the abortion controversy, we talk with the director, Joan Micklin Silver, who also directed Hester Street, Between the Lines, and Crossing Delancey. Also a talk with Greg Tate. He writes about African-American pop culture for The Village Voice. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Side by Side, the new album by Marty Ehrlich. And book critic John Leonard reviews Alice Walker's new novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Russian President Boris Yeltsin became the first Russian or Soviet leader to speak before a joint session of Congress. Yeltsin is seeking U.S. support for a $24 billion international aid package to Russia. He told lawmakers he'll continue with economic reforms and that communism will never rise again in Russia. Yeltsin asked the U.S. to join Russia in a partnership.
Today, free and democratic Russia is extending its hand of friendship to the people of America. Acting on the will of the people of Russia, I am inviting you, and through you, the people of the United States, to join us in partnership in the quest for freedom and justice in the 21st century.
Congressional leaders said Yeltsin made a strong case for economic aid and that approval was likely. Some lawmakers had said the U.S. shouldn't help Russia until Yeltsin clears up the issue of missing American soldiers from the Vietnam War, allegedly held in Soviet camps. New York City police today are searching for another arsonist in a series of 12 hotel fires. Officials are blaming a Philadelphia teenager for at least half of those. They suspect another person was behind at least four fires. The blazes began June 6th. Mayor David Dinkins called a news conference yesterday to allay fears before the Democratic convention in New York next month. The federal government has told Maryland not to impose a new gas guzzler tax, saying the tax violates federal guidelines. Maryland's law imposes a surcharge on consumers who buy cars with low gas mileage and gives a tax credit to people buying fuel-efficient cars. The law was supposed to go into effect July 1st. Maryland hasn't decided yet whether it will challenge the ban. Today is the 20th anniversary of Watergate, a scandal that eventually brought down the Nixon administration. One of the reporters who first broke the story, Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward, appeared on Talk of the Nation today to discuss the legacy of Watergate. Woodward believes a straight line can be drawn from Watergate to the current Ross Perot phenomenon.
There has been layer and layer of malfeasance, incompetence, criminality in government, and people are saying, come on, something is really eating away at the way the government works. We are going to have to do better. We are going to have to reform it. And I think the basic attitude is, let's break it. Let's throw the experienced people out. Let's take the people who are politicians and smash them and bring in this innocent outsider and give it another shot.
Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward. A coalition of environmental groups is skeptical of the proposed North American Free Trade Agreement. The Natural Resources Defense Council released a study today saying the trade pact doesn't have adequate safeguards to protect the environment. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 42.77 points at 3286.72 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. National Guard troops are cleaning up today from tornadoes that struck Minnesota yesterday. The storms overturned buildings and destroyed cars. About 40 people were hurt. No one was killed. The World Health Organization today warns tuberculosis is making a powerful comeback in America and Western Europe. TB was once practically eliminated by antibiotics. Now new drug-resistant strains have hit the U.S. A senior PLO official says he hopes the Middle East peace talks will resume in July after Israeli elections this month. He urged the U.S. to set a timetable for transitional Palestinian rule by November. New York Telephone has announced it will block all long-distance calls made from payphones in the Times Square area. NPR's Maria Hinojosa reports.
The calls will be blocked, according to the telephone company, because of the increasing use of fraudulent phone cards to make long-distance calls around the world. Times Square has long been a popular outlet for people looking to spend hours on the phone, but only having to pay about $10 for each call. It's become increasingly common to see people from all nationalities standing in short lines around public phones. They then pay a growing network of thieves who steal calling card numbers or tap into a business's telephone system and then sell the discounted overseas calls. A New York Telephone spokeswoman said other areas around New York City would also be affected by the blockage. She said telephone fraud is estimated at more than $1 billion a year nationwide. In New York, this is Maria Hinojosa reporting.
Two German hostages were reunited with their families today. The men were released this morning and met relatives on the Mediterranean island of Crete. The Germans were the last Western hostages in Lebanon. They flew to Germany later today. The Bosnian capital, Sarajevo, came under heavy shelling from Serb gunners around the hills and around the city today. A UN official in Sarajevo called the fighting all-out war. The gunfire began last night, breaking a ceasefire that had brought a brief period of relative calm. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Joan Micklin-Silver made her first film in 1973, she was one of the only women directing. The film was made independently on a shoestring budget, but it proved she was good. The film was Hester Street. It starred Carol Kane as a newly arrived Russian-Jewish immigrant to New York's Lower East Side. Silver followed that with Between the Lines, Chilly Scenes of Winter, and Crossing Delancey. You can see her new movie, A Private Matter, this month on HBO. This movie dramatizes the abortion controversy. It's set in 1962, when abortion was illegal. It's based on the true story of Sherry Chesson Finkbein, who tried to have a medically sanctioned abortion after learning the thalidomide she'd taken as a tranquilizer would likely cause severe deformation of her baby. When she tried to spread the word about the dangers of thalidomide, the word also got out that she wanted an abortion. As a result, she lost her job as the local host of the children's show Romper Room, and she was harassed by death threats. Sissy Spacek and Aidan Quinn star. I asked Joan Micklin-Silver if she ran up against any obstacles in making a TV movie about abortion.
The obstacles that it ran into were actually before I came on board, but I know that the producers did try to or consider trying to make it for one of the networks. And I don't think the networks would have been interested in doing this. NBC had made a movie that dealt with Roe versus Wade and had lost a great deal of money from advertisers, and I think that was enough to scare them all off.
Did HBO have any qualifiers when it accepted the movie?
None that I know of. I think they wanted to have a good cast, but I imagine they want to have a good cast for just about everything that they do. They don't have the same problem. They don't have advertisers that they have to satisfy or appease or get around in order to put the movies on the air. So it does mean that they have a chance to do harder-hitting shows and perhaps shows with a little bit more depth and breadth.
How did you get in on the project?
I was just asked by HBO and by the producers. And in fact, when I was first sent it, my agent called and said that they wanted to send it to me, and I said, please don't send it, because I remember this incident perfectly. It happened in 1962. I was having my children around the same time. My children were born in 58, 60, and 63. And I was a young mother in my 20s, and it was just a terrifying incident to me, as I'm sure it was to many people. Almost everyone remembers it. They remember the Pictures in Life magazine, and they remember what this young woman was subjected to. And honestly, I said, I had such an anxiety about it at the time, I don't think I want to go through it again. But then by the next day, I thought to myself, well, perhaps I should do it, just because I did have such passionate feelings about it. And they sent the script, and I was pleasantly surprised that it was such a good script. William Nicholson, an English playwright, wrote it.
Maybe I'm just a couple of years too young to have been reading the news magazines then, but I don't remember the story from its time. What really stuck in your mind? What images or what?
Well, Sherry was the teacher of Romper Room, which was an extremely popular show among very young children. And Romper Room was a franchise. There was a different Romper Room lady, as we call them then, in every city. And I was living in Cleveland at the time. Sherry was living in Phoenix, and she was the Romper Room lady in her city. So it was already associated with something that you connected with your kids to begin with, because my kids just loved the Romper Room in Cleveland. And she then was hounded and harassed and was unable to get an abortion. And I was also a young woman who knew that I wanted a certain amount of children and no more. And to see what she had to go through was a very cautionary thing.
So it kind of frightened you, like, what if...
Absolutely.
Right. You were really one of the first women directors of feature films. Now, you got started comparatively late in life for a director. You'd already, I think, raised three children.
Well, I hadn't totally raised them.
Oh,
I certainly had three children.
You had three children.
They were past preschool years.
I see, right. And you had spent a few years teaching in a school for the mentally impaired?
A school for emotionally disturbed children.
Okay. When did you realize you wanted to direct?
After I wrote my first screenplay and saw what happened to it. I always wanted to direct, but I had had a sort of a nice, oh, one could even say a ladylike plan of, you know, writing screenplays, having them brought to the screen by all the great directors, learning from each one, and then at the perfect moment stepping out and directing my own. But that only lasted as long as it took to have one screenplay made in Hollywood. And after that, I decided that if anybody was going to ruin my things, I would ruin my things.
What was the screenplay?
It was called Limbo. I was fired from it. It was an original screenplay about three wives of POWs and MIAs in Vietnam. It was like an early anti-Vietnam piece, and I had meant it to be kind of a gritty piece in which you saw these three wives of professional soldiers who'd become extremely radicalized by their experience, and it was all based on the research that I'd done. And I was replaced by another writer, and the director, Mark Robeson, who had prior to that certainly made some interesting films, saw it very differently, and he had every right to see it any way he wanted to, but it did not in any way represent what I thought the piece should be. He saw it more as a sort of, woman's movie in big quotes. It was kind of sudsy and didn't have what I felt was the force of these women. And I thought the idea of women whose husbands were professional pilots and who'd never in their lives thought about any sort of political protest and who were suddenly radicalized by this experience, that's what gripped me about it. And that was not what gripped him. And he made a different kind of a movie out of it. Interestingly, he was generous enough to invite me, a disgruntled screenwriter and a fired screenwriter at that, onto his set, which was in Florida, and to allow me to do just about anything I wanted to do, to look through the camera and to talk to anybody and to stick around. And I thought that was extremely generous of him. I don't know that I would be as generous with a screenwriter that was, you know, I had replaced. But it gave me a big chance just to see how films are put together. And I learned a lot.
Now, Hester Street, which is your first feature film,
mm-hmm.
you did that pretty independently, right?
Yes, absolutely. My husband had seen me floundering around, and I was able to get work as a screenwriter but not as a director, and he thought it was rather unfair. And he said, well, you may or you may not have talent. You certainly deserve the chance to find out. So he was and is a real estate developer and said that he would, he was used to doing real estate syndications, which means raising money for projects. And he said if I could write something and keep the costs really down, he would produce it for me and raise the money to make it. So that was what we did with Hester Street.
Now, how did you feel about that? Did that make it easier or more difficult knowing that it wasn't like the impersonal industry that was producing the film? It was like your husband. Do you know what I mean? And it was his time, and the risk became a more personal risk in a way, because I believe you also used some of your family money.
Some, but I mean, basically raised it. Except that we both felt that, you know, that we would make the movie, we'd pay back our investors, it wouldn't be a problem, and I somehow didn't go into it thinking that we were going to fail. We thought we, you know, would have at least enough success to pay people back. But as it happened, no one wanted to release the movie. And I was in a position of thinking I had made a movie that couldn't be released and that we owed money on it. And it was pretty dreadful. But we were invited to the Cannes Film Festival, where it played very well and got wonderful reviews. And Race sold the rights to the movie in four territories. It was England, Switzerland, I can't even remember what the other ones were. And we used the money from those to open it in New York, and then it got a great rave in the New York Times, so that kind of built from there. So, in fact, everybody got paid back.
Hester Street is set on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, where so many of the Eastern European and Russian immigrants came. And so you had the difficult task of making your first movie a period film, where, you had to redo the street that you shot it on to make it look like it was a period. You had to get costumes that looked right. The people had to have Yiddish accents and in some cases speak Yiddish as well. I mean, that really presents a lot of obstacles.
It was formidable when I think about it, but I'll tell you something. I had had an awful lot of trouble by then, and there was such terrific sexism in the industry, I didn't know if I'd ever get to make another movie. And I thought, I'm going to make one that counts for my family. My family were Russian Jewish immigrants. Both my parents were just full of immigrant stories, and they're my aunts and uncles, and all, you know, I just heard them from childhood, and I wanted very much to deal with that period. And I guess I didn't think so much of how hard it was all going to be. And truly, when you do your first film, you get an awful lot of help.
If you're just joining us, my guest is director Joan Micklin-Silver, and her movies include Hester Street, Between the Lines, and Crossing the Lancy. Her latest movie, A Private Matter, will premiere on HBO this Saturday night. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Director Joan Micklin-Silver is my guest. Well, you were telling us how difficult it was to make Hester Street and how shut out you were from the movie-making industry because you were a woman. How did you get to make your second movie after Hester Street?
After Hester Street, I did have a little bit of interest. I did have some people come to me and say, all right, what do you want to make next? And by that time, I had found the material for Between the Lines, which was written by a writer named Fred Barron. It was about the alternative press in Boston, papers like The Real Paper and the Boston Phoenix. And I liked the material a lot and wanted very much to do a piece in which there were a lot of main characters. And that was not the kind of thing that anybody wanted to back me doing. I don't think these multi-character things do too well in Hollywood. And even when they're brilliantly done, say Nashville, I mean, they somehow just never, their success disdain, if that's the pronunciation, but they really don't seem somehow to crack the big commercial nuts. And Ray said to me, you know, I don't think you're ever going to find anybody who's going to back this film. And he said, I think we ought to take the money that we made from our share of Hester Street and make it. So we did.
Oh, so you went independent again the second time?
Yes.
Yeah, Between the Lines is a really interesting and entertaining film. And it has a cast of people who went on to become very well known and who were, I think, completely unknown then, including Lindsay Krause, Jill Eikenberry, Jeff Goldblum, John Hurd. What was it like to cast that movie?
Well, I had a wonderful casting director who helped me with it, Juliette Taylor. The nice part was
didn't she go on to work with Woody Allen?
Oh, yeah, she's gone on to do wonderful things, and she's an excellent casting director. I think she was even working with Woody Allen at the time, as far as I know, yeah. Uh-huh. The nice part was that they were all young. They all were extremely gung-ho, and they just threw themselves into it. I remember one wonderful afternoon in Boston. We did a lot of improv working on the script, and I guess my AD came to me and said, don't have people come in for rehearsals tomorrow because they have to have a day off because of Screen Actors Guild rules and so on. And I said, oh, okay. So I announced that at the rehearsal, and I said, we can't rehearse tomorrow because of these rules. And I said, however, I will be in my hotel room tomorrow afternoon, and anybody who wants to come by is welcome to come by. So, of course, they all showed up, and we continued rehearsing. Hmm. We were just an incredibly enthusiastic group.
Right. Between the Lines, I think, was a critical success and did pretty well at the box office. It certainly played commercial theaters around the country. Was that enough to get you deeper into the industry?
Not really. The next project that came along that I wanted to do was Chilly Scenes of Winter, and I had read the novel. And then
an Ann Beattie novel.
An Ann Beattie novel, a wonderful novel. And then I read in the I can't remember where I read it. I think it was Publishers Weekly or something like that, that the rights to it had been bought by three actors who wanted to begin their careers as producers. And I was just furious somebody bought my book because I'd always loved that book and wanted to do it and had worked with John Hurd on Between the Lines and had thought he would be awfully good for the main character. But I knew one of the actors who had read for me once and called him and asked if they wanted to talk about getting together on it because I really wanted to write and direct it. And we got together and we did do it. And this was the first project for what was then Triple Play, now Double Play Productions, Amy Robinson and Griffin Dunn, Mark Metcalf, who have gone on certainly to be very excellent producers.
Mm-hmm. The novel that the movie was based on is Chilly Scenes of Winter. The movie was renamed Head Over Heels. What was the story behind that?
Well, it was done for UA. And at that time, UA was sort of in a transitional period, and there was a sort of split between the people on the East Coast who were in charge of the marketing and then the people who were in the so-called creative people who were on the West Coast. Well, the people on the West Coast loved the movie, and the people on the East Coast hated the movie. And they felt that the title Chilly Scenes of Winter suggested snow and Ingmar Bergman, and as if that was something wrong, and would discourage people from wanting to come and see it. So we petitioned them, begged them, wanted so much to retain the title, which I loved. And they said that they wouldn't release it under that title, and we didn't have a choice. They released it under the title Head Over Heels, and it barely made a little, blip on the screen and was gone soon at the bottom of double features and stuff like that. And it was kind of a sad thing. But then the Classics Division of UA wanted to re-release the film. And they only had two things they wanted to do. They wanted to re-release it with the original title, Chilly Scenes of Winter. And they also asked about the ending. The ending of the film is similar to the ending of the novel in that the young man who has obsessed during the entire movie over this young woman finally does get her. And when I wrote the screenplay, I followed that line of action that was in the novel. They released the film so fast, I never really had a chance to screen it with people. But once I screened it after it had been released and failed, I screened it with for film schools and various kinds of audiences, and could see that the ending didn't work because the way the film went and the strengths of the film were such that you did not want him to get the girl. You simply wanted him to get over the obsession. So we were able to take out the last scene, which would certainly fit into what I wanted as well, and then we released it, and it did much better.
Now, you're still working as a team with your husband as producer?
Well, for some time, we haven't had an opportunity to work together, but just recently we've started a small company called Silver Film, of course, and we want very much to make the sorts of films that maybe don't get made, but that we'd like to see, and films which use New York talent, because I live in New York and very much interested in people who live there and the great array of talent, the big talent pool in New York.
Joan Micklin-Silver. Her new film, A Private Matter, premieres Saturday night on HBO. Saxophonist, clarinetist, and flutist Marty Ehrlich is one of the busiest and most respected sidemen on the New York jazz scene. He's worked with Mujal, Richard Abrams, Leroy Jenkins, Anthony Davis, and Bobby Previtt, as well as with his own trio and quartet. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has been listening to Ehrlich for years. He says it's time Ehrlich received greater recognition.
When people talk about the New York jazz scene, they're really talking about a lot of them. Musicians are apt to be defensive and a little clannish. Ground down by a hostile economy and endless haranguing between liberal and conservative factions, they retreat into cliques. The cliques regard each other with the same resentments, misconceptions, and envy that characterize any small-town feud. Or else they're just unaware of each other, inhabiting parallel worlds that rarely, if ever, intersect. Lately, some of the most encouraging records coming from New York cut across the usual lines to bring together people who don't normally make the same sessions. These records are conceived by those rare musicians who do travel in a variety of circles and want to break down the walls. Musicians like Marty Ehrlich. His new album for the Angel label is Side by Side. We'll be right back. Marty Ehrlich's quintet reunites the great veteran drummer Andrew Cyrille with the fine bassist Anthony Cox. Cyrille had worked with Cox before, but not with trombonist Frank Lacy, who's played in just about every big band in New York. On piano is Seattle-based Wayne Horvitz, who these days plays electric keyboards in his group The President. He's a good pianist and improviser, but other musicians don't always think of him as a jazz player. Ehrlich puts Horvitz's outsider perspective and compositional smarts to good use. On Billy Strayhorn's Johnny Come Lately, Horvitz weaves his piano around the scored figures the horns play behind him, then jumps in to fill up open space when they back off. Those background horn figures are typical of Marty Ehrlich's attention to detail. The music on his new album ranges from that Ellington swinger to a modern chamber piece by Ehrlich, who wrote most of the album. But this isn't one of those trendy records where the leader ticks off one style after another to demonstrate competence in select areas, as if making records was like taking a driver's license road test. Ehrlich mixes up styles the way he mixes players. For instance, he slips a conspicuous Coltrane lick into the theme of his composition, Side by Side. But then the improvising goes off in a rather un-Coltrane-like direction, with leapfrogging horns. It's like you thought he was going to parallel park, and he made a three-point turn. Everybody sounds good on this record, especially Marty Ehrlich. He's always played written music with great feeling. That's one reason he works so much. But for me, he's only lately blossomed as a soloist. This is from his ballad, Far West Woman. Marty Ehrlich has vision, a sense of what music can do and what he can do with it. The best thing about his new record is that he makes his diverse players sound like a band, makes them feel and hear what he's getting at. That's one mark of a great leader. With Side by Side, you can hear Marty Ehrlich coming into his own.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic and record annotator living in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Flyboy in the Buttermilk. We'll talk to Greg Tate, who writes about music, literature, and African-American culture for the Village Voice. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Saturday Morning Murder by Israeli writer Batya Gur. It's a novel about a murder at a psychoanalytic institute. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Russian President Boris Yeltsin made his pitch to Congress this morning for a $24 billion aid package. The Russian president said that there will be no second try to get a free market economy as he spoke before a joint meeting of Congress. He also told Congress that he will spare no effort to find out what happened to U.S. prisoners of war in the former Soviet Union, as he tried to head off efforts to tie the fate of missing Americans to Western aid. This afternoon, he and President Bush signed an arms reduction treaty to cut thousands of nuclear weapons. Two German hostages, once held in Lebanon for more than 3 years, are now back in Germany. They have been taken to a hospital for medical testing and treatment. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Thomas Kempner and Heinrich Strubig walked off the plane at the Cologne-Bonn airport without help after 3 years in the captivity of Islamic fundamentalists. The two gaunt-looking men waved to reporters but made no comments on their prison conditions. German Chancellery official Bernd Schmidbauer, who left Beirut this morning with the two former hostages, said they were kept in chains for most of their captivity. Despite reports earlier this week of their release, Schmidbauer said the two relief aid workers first learned earlier today they would be freed. Kempner and Strubig, the last two Western hostages in Lebanon, were held by members of the Hamadi clan. The family tried unsuccessfully to swap the two German hostages for two Hamadi brothers serving long sentences in Germany on terrorism convictions. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
U.S. Attorney General William Barr has given a vote of confidence to the Department of Justice's Nazi hunting office, despite recent reports that the office misplaced key evidence in the case of an accused war criminal. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The Justice Department's Office of Special Investigations, or OSI, admitted last Friday that it had evidence that might have helped retired Cleveland auto worker John Demjanjuk fight his extradition from the U.S. to Israel in 1986. Demjanjuk was tried and convicted in Israel of being the notorious Ivan the Terrible, who ran the gas chamber at the Treblinka death camp during World War II. But at the time Demjanjuk was being extradited, OSI failed to give his lawyers information they now say they had, showing that Treblinka guards had named another man as the gas chamber operator. Today, Attorney General Barr told the Associated Press he has confidence in the OSI, saying, quote, "They have an important job to do, and it has to be continued." Some, including presidential candidate Pat Buchanan, have called for the abolition of the office. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
According to the American Petroleum Institute, crude oil production last month in the U.S. reached its lowest level in 31 years. The U.S. is one of the world's largest oil-producing countries and the number one oil consumer. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials dropped nearly 42 points in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. Republican Senator John McCain says he no longer plans to oppose an aid package for the former Soviet Union because of concerns about missing POWs who might be in Russia. Some members of Congress have indicated that they would like to hold up an aid package until questions about the fate of the missing servicemen are answered. Russian leader Boris Yeltsin has said that some American prisoners might still be alive in Russia, and if they are, he will send them home. A new study offers some reassurance to women who have had their breasts enlarged with silicone implants. Researchers report in the New England Journal of Medicine that silicone implants do not seem to increase a woman's risk of developing breast cancer. NPR's Michael Scholar has more.
Silicone breast implants have been blamed for many health problems. This new study focused on just one, breast cancer. Researchers looked at health insurance records for more than 11,000 Canadian women who had their breasts enlarged with implants. After about 10 years, these women had a much lower rate of breast cancer than usual for their age. The researchers say this shows implants don't cause cancer. But not all experts are ready to accept that conclusion. Some say the study is flawed. It could be that women who got the implants just started out with a very low risk of getting breast cancer because, for example, they had small breasts or were very health conscious. If so, any cancer risk added by implants might be hidden. The National Cancer Institute plans to start a 4-year study this fall to help settle whether cancer and other diseases are linked to breast implants. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
Voters go to the polls in Ireland tomorrow to cast their ballots on a key treaty on unification in Europe. A new survey for the Irish Times indicates support for a centralized European community government because of financial benefits. According to this survey, 49% of those contacted support ratification, with 28% opposed. This is NPR News in...
This is Fresh Air. Flyboy in the Buttermilk is a new collection of essays by Greg Tate about race, politics, literature, and music. Tate writes for the Village Voice. The introduction to his book was written by Henry Louis Gates, chair of Harvard's African American Studies Department. Gates describes Tate as a leading intellectual exponent of the hip-hop generation. Required reading. Greg Tate, along with guitarist Vernon Reed, co-founded the Black Rock Coalition, a group of African American musicians who play rock and have had trouble breaking into the music industry because blacks are expected to play funk or rap, not rock. Tate often writes about music, rock, jazz, funk, and rap. His style of writing is sometimes straight ahead, but sometimes he writes in a style he describes as freaky deek.
Well, I think what I've tried to do is be true to my own impulses as a critic. And I mean, those impulses, I take my directives from the kind of music and the kind of art and the kind of literature that I like. And I've always tried to produce critical writing that had as much vitality and viscerality as the art or the phenomena or the experience that I was trying to describe to someone else. I'm really trying to plug a reader into my central nervous system in its most hot-wired state.
One of the forms of music you've written a lot about is rap, and there's a lot of the music that you really like a lot. On the other hand, you take issue with a lot of the points of view in the rock records. You once described Public Enemy as having a whack, retarded philosophy they espouse. What kinds of dilemmas does rap music present for you?
Well, I don't know that rap presents any more of a dilemma to me than any other form of music or any other form of argument. I think that one of the things that rap or hip-hop isn't given enough credit for is the way the spaces it opens for, you know, I think serious intellectual discussion around a lot of issues that are shrouded in silence in society, and particularly in African-American society, particularly issues around sexuality and gender, and also oppositional politics, and also the experience of working class black people and poor black people, people on the lower economic rung of the society. And that's, you know, and that's part of what hip hop does. I think hip hop is a venue for debate more than anything else, you know, and for argument and counter-argument.
Let me read an excerpt from your essay, The Devil Made Him Do It, Public Enemy. You write, to know Public Enemy is to love the agitprop and artful noise and to worry over the whack, retarded philosophy they espouse, like the black woman has always been kept up by the white male because the white male has always wanted the black woman, like gays aren't doing what's needed to build the black nation, like white people are actually monkeys' uncles because that's who they made it with in the Caucasian hills. Like, if the Palestinians took up arms, went into Israel, and killed all the Jews, it'd be all right. From this idiot blather, Public Enemy is obviously making it up as they go along. Since PE shows sound reasoning when they focus on racism as a tool of the U.S. power structure, they should be intelligent enough to realize that dehumanizing gays, women, and Jews isn't going to set black people free. You got a reaction from Public Enemy to this piece?
Well, I got a reaction from Chuck D at a concert they did the week after it came out, where it was kind of funny because I wasn't even in town. I was in Greece at an African reggae music festival that I've been invited to for a weekend. But I heard that, you know, I was referred to as a Village Voice porch nigger by Chuck in response to that, in that piece. But we since made peace, you know. He actually apologized to me for saying that.
Well, I think he apologized to you while you were interviewing him for a piece in the Village Voice.
Right.
And in that piece, you were doing the interview along with Robert Crisco, who was the former, or is the former, music editor of The Voice.
Right.
And you were both really trying to, among other things, talk to Chuck D of Public Enemy about gay bashing. And
homophobia.
Homophobia, yeah. And I don't think you were really getting through very far. What did you think? I mean, what was your approach to trying to talk with him about that?
To recognize the, you know, humanity of people who are gay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think he acknowledged it without ever acknowledging that he would ever be comfortable with it, you know. I think he was able to acknowledge it in theory, but I don't think in practice, you know.
You know,
that was the case.
So some people are just totally threatened by rap music altogether and can't deal with it. Some people just, you know, love the message, love the music, and some people, and I think you're probably in this category, really love a lot about it, but feel that they have to speak out about parts that they find really offensive, like the misogyny.
Well, certainly. I mean, and I think that because so many people are so terrified of who makes rap music and, to a certain extent, who consumes it and who they believe is influenced by it, that they lose sight of the fact that what makes it so powerful is courageous utterance. You know, I'm not saying wise, always profound, always insightful utterance, but it is about a personal truth. And I think that too often people are trying to deal with their fear of a black planet, as Public Enemy put it, through attacking the music or the messages in the music, you know, more than they're seeing that this is about one person who has an opinion and he put it to a beat and he gave it a good hook and he delivered it in a style that by the tenets of the music, it should be menacing and seductive.
My guest is Greg Tate, author of the new collection of essays, Flyboy in the Buttermilk. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Greg Tate writes about culture and race for The Village Voice. One of your essays in your new collection, Flyboy and the Buttermilk, was about the rape of the Central Park jogger a couple of years ago. And let me quote a little bit of what you wrote in that. You wrote, "The extent to which this case of gang rape is an expression of sexism run amok in the black community remains ignored by the black press." How did you decide to pick up on that sexism in your coverage?
Well, I'm trying to figure out the best way to say this. I am trying to be a feminist man. I'll say it that way. And I'm very concerned with not just sexism in the black community, but silence around sexism in the black community. And I think that as a black man, it's irresponsible not to address that silence whenever and wherever it, you know, kind of rears this invisible head.
Let me quote something from another essay. You write that in your earlier days you were very much the aesthetician. You write, I believe that black cultural difference was going to set us free, that our salvation and liberation would come in realizing how great black art set us apart from the illen white boy and his creations. Tell me why you started believing that art would be, art and culture would be capable of so much, and when you stopped believing it.
Well, I think that when I was younger, my identity was empowered by the experiences I had, collective experiences I had with other black people in a musical context.
What were some of those key experiences that really excited you?
Every concert I went to in Washington. I mean, a lot of it had to do with Washington itself being a predominantly black city where you could have, where essentially all of one's intellectual and artistic and spiritual experiences happened in a collective sense with pretty much the gamut of the black community. And there was an energy that one could draw on there that is not available in integrated, you know, or certainly predominantly white settings. You know, when you may be seeing the same artist, there's a call and response that goes on. There's a circular loop of energy that moves between the audience and the performers. And certainly seeing George Clinton in Parliament, Funkadelic, you know, really epitomized that for me, because I think that they broke the fourth wall down between the experience on stage and the experience in the audience more dramatically than anything I've seen outside of the Baptist church. As George Clinton so elegantly put it, one nation under a groove.
So when did you stop believing that good music, good art could set you free or set set all black people free? You know what I mean? Just could be a total liberating experience.
Well, I think somehow over time I realized that people could not carry the experience that they had within the concert hall into the street, into their personal lives. You know, that release, that openness, that kind of sharing, mm-hmm. you know, that other kinds of experiences and other kind of discourse and other kind of dialogue was going to have to be necessary to make those kind of, that kind of consciousness and that kind of awareness available to people.
You mentioned in one of your essays that your mother was very active in civil rights groups and politically active as well. She was a press secretary for Jesse Jackson during one of his presidential campaigns, press secretary for Marion Barry during his first mayoral campaign. What kind of political values were stressed in the house when you were growing up?
Be black. You know, it was, I mean, it was very interesting because my parents were doing were activists, and it wasn't even like these things were stressed; they were just lived. I mean, you were just aware of the fact that your parents were involved in a historic struggle against racial injustice in America, and we read all the things that my parents read. You know, there was a consciousness in the house around securing information and the understanding that knowledge is power, and that black people needed knowledge to be empowered, to be able to participate in a fight against injustice.
So education was really important,
but not overemphasized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really am trying to stress the fact that it was that these things were, in a real casual kind of way, part of the environment. The intensity of political struggle in black America in the 60s and 70s was a very casual part of the environment. You know, it was just something you accepted as normal. I thought, you know, this is the way everybody lived. I thought everybody was in my neighborhood was getting this kind of information from their parents, you know. That wasn't subsequently found that wasn't the case, but
if you don't mind my asking, I'm wondering what your mother's take has been about the kind of b-boy writing that you've done, you know, in the kinds of pieces where you use real b-boy kind of language, real hip-hop language. And
you know, I have one of those mothers who's like the biggest fan of anything,
right,
that their kids do. It's like as long as it's said from the heart, as long as it's done with integrity and style, my mother's totally down with it.
Did you ever feel like you were rebelling against your parents or against being part of the black middle class in any way by writing in that kind of style or by, you know, having dreads?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, because, like I said, my parents are what we call movement people. You know, they were always involved in the movement. So that meant they were always involved with younger black people who were rebelling, you know, I mean, against their own parents or their upbringings. But my parents were totally open to the shape and form that the black struggle took when younger black people of another generation, you know, moved to the forefront of it. And, you know, my mother's one of Public Enemy's biggest fans, you know. I mean, there was a period where I know she was playing Nation of Millions every day. My father was getting sick of it. You know, it's like every morning, boom, bring the noise. You know, and like me, she knows all the lyrics, you know, backwards and forwards. You know, it's like I say, I mean, if it's done with style and integrity, if it's pro-black, my mother is with it.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a great interview. I really enjoyed myself.
Greg Tate's new collection of essays is called Flyboy in the Buttermilk. It's published by Simon & Schuster. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on Boris Yeltsin's visit to Washington?
He spoke to the Congress today, Terry, and told them that if there are any POWs in what used to be the Soviet Union, that he will find them and send them home to their families. He also said communism will never rise again in Russia. And then he said to the Congress, basically, please send money. We're going to take a look at the motor voter bill, which passed yesterday, examine it from the point of view of some states which have similar legislation and see how it works. We're going to take a second look at the Naval Aviators' drunken bash in Las Vegas. And Robert Siegel has an interview with an author who's written a book called The Guillotine in Art and Literature.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Israeli novelist Batya Gur has written three mystery novels featuring Chief Inspector Michael Ohayon of the Jerusalem Police. John Leonard has a review of her latest, The Saturday Morning Murder.
Imagine a clutch, or maybe even a coven, of highly powered and highly intelligent psychoanalysts, together behind locked doors at their own exclusive training institute in the exceedingly neurotic imperial city of Jerusalem. When one of them is murdered, shot dead in the chair from which she used to listen to her troubled patients on their obligatory couch, just hours before she was to deliver a lecture on the ethics of her profession. Almost everybody seems to have admired Eva Niedorf, but the text to her lecture is missing, and so are her notes, and so is her appointment book and a list of her patients. Chief Inspector Michael Ohayon of the Jerusalem Police must ask all sorts of questions of people who are just as clever as he is at the business of interrogation. There's a hospital for the mentally disturbed right next door to the Psychoanalytic Institute, and there's a military governor of one of the occupied territories who behaves suspiciously, and there are occasional Arabs from one of the camps who trouble the composure of the investigators, like ghosts or maybe symbols of the repressed. But Ohayon is pretty much persuaded that another doctor must have done the dirty deed, and for reasons every bit as devious as the coded dreams of Sigmund Freud himself. At one point, the detective goes with his son to a science fiction movie called Alien Passenger, in which, on a space flight, an evil shape-changing presence destroys one by one the members of the crew from Earth. He is haunted thereafter by this notion of an alien passenger, and so, of course, are the psychoanalysts, even when they are reading German poetry. The Saturday Morning Murder comes with blurbs from Amos Oz and Shimon Peres. Batya Gur teaches literature in Jerusalem. If her two previous Michael Ohayon novels haven't yet been translated into English, I am willing to learn Hebrew to read them. Jerusalem is splendidly evoked, but from the inside, with rumors instead of trumpets. Everybody smokes too much in rooms that are never warm enough, and there's a sense about of heavy history, erotic greed, frazzled will, and guilty conscience. We are acquainted step by step with the esoteric, and yet no bumptious fun is made of the analysts or of their secrets. They are permitted, most of them anyway, to be as complicated and humane as the detective who puzzles out their motives and their meanings. If they're desperate to belong to something, well, so are we all. The murder of one of their own, perhaps by one of their own, violates not only their oath, but their idea of themselves and their faith in their profession. And Ohayon, of course, comes to identify with their passionate commitment. If there is something called the loneliness of the therapist, so is a policeman lonely. Like the detective, who was trained at university as a medievalist, they have what he calls an historical need to know, to obtain, he says, a full picture, to see everything concerning human beings as part of an overall process, possessing laws of its own. Finally, in order to trap the killer, the psychoanalysts will have to betray one of their own most sacred principles. I can't remember a more satisfying mystery.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Saturday Morning Murder by Batya Gur. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with associate producer Joan Tuohy and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the ethnic fighting in the Balkans is tragic. Mordecai Richler says the ethnic split in Canada is ridiculous. Richler is one of Canada's most celebrated novelists, the author of The Apprenticeship of Judy Kravitz and Joshua Then and Now. His new book examines the French separatist movement in Quebec, where he lives. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.